Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 894. That's a big number. This episode brought to you by Squarespace. If you need a portfolio, or if you need an online store because you made a thing that I keep telling you to do, and you want to sell that thing, you just want to show people that thing, or maybe just a blog, you got feels, man. Squarespace gives you everything you need to make your next move into a reality, and also beautifully designed templates and customizable features. You can create a beautiful website simply, intuitively, just add and arrange your content with the click of a mouse. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. Enter the offer code Nerdist to get 10% off your first purchase. Hey, Katie, what's on the Nerdist Community Corkboard?
I'm not here right now.
Okay, I'll do it then. EJ Espinoza writes, I used to live in LA, but recently moved up to Santa Maria. I miss the art community of Los Angeles, so I launched my own small business called Arte Munda. I collaborate with local artists in the Central Coast. We make t-shirts. Each month, introduce a new artist for each shirt that is sold. A portion of the proceeds goes back to the artist, and another portion goes to local schools to keep their art programs going. What a great idea. I already have about 20 artists I'm working with, ranging from beginners to professionals. Find out more info or buy a shirt from artemunda.com, artemunda.com. Kevin writes, I work for the American Cancer Society. We're launching a whole new way to fight cancer, CuraCon. It's a comic entertainment convention like many others, but unlike the others, the proceeds from CuraCon go directly to providing services for people fighting cancer and to fund research that will hopefully lead to a cancer-free tomorrow. It's a convention with games and cosplay and exhibitors and photo shoots, and simply by buying a ticket or becoming a sponsor or vendor, people are helping to support the cause of ending cancer. The first ever Curathon is being held at the Kellogg Arena in Battle Creek, Michigan, November 10th through the 12th. This year, and we're doing like a silent auction, professional cosplay photo shoots, free limited edition CuraCon shirt for all advanced purchase weekend passes. Also, something really cool and novel, a VIP pass called The Lair. It comes with two weekend passes and an actual semi-private booth that you get during the convention for personal use. Tickets and info at curacon.org, CuraCon.org. Hope this is a big success. We're able to raise a lot of funds to fight cancer. We can turn this into an annual event. Anyone who wants to help but can't make the trip to Michigan is more than welcome to donate as well. There's a button right in the homepage for it. Wow. You guys, I am proud of you making things to benefit other people. Nicely done. Very, very, very nicely done. You can submit your events to events@nerdist.com and we'll pour through them. Katie will slap them on here and read them. I think she reads them better than I do. I like it when she does it. See, now these folks have made such amazing stuff, and I was just going to promote. Nah, I got some stand-up dates coming up. I'm such an asshole! These dates are to benefit no one but me. I am sorry. I need to put these dates up somewhere. You know, right now, there's a website called Dead Frog with a hyphen in the middle of it. And Dead Frog / comedians, there's like a tour dates thing in there that I found. And that's where my dates are being listed. I really need to get on this internet thing. I just don't think it's going to last, to be honest. I don't buy it. Nice try. But September 28, 29, and 30, I'll be at Acme Comedy Company in Minneapolis. October 5th through 7th. I will be at the Tacoma Comedy Club in Tacoma, Washington. Then the American Comedy Company in San Diego, October 19 through 21. Brea Improv, November 3rd, 4th. And then November 8th through the 10th, I'll be at the New York Comedy Festival at Caroline's. So, yeah, there's tickets for all that stuff on there somewhere. And now I'm just doing a Norm MacDonald impersonation. I miss that guy. I wish he'd come back on my show. All right, this episode is Nick Swardson, my dear, dear, dear friend Nick Swardson, whom I adore. I love that guy so much. He's currently promoting season 2 of Typical Rick, which is on CC.com. It's a network called Comedy Central that sounds vaguely familiar. And yeah, I love him. I don't know what to say. I love Nick Swardson. I fucking love him. And he's hilarious on the podcast. He's hilarious. If you get a chance, you should see him live. I adore this man. This episode also brought to you by Casper. Casper mattresses. They are outrageously comfortable. They are on a million podcasts. I'm sure you've heard about them, but it does live up to the hype. Real customers have said that Casper is like sleeping on brioche. How many times have you been stuffing brioche in your mouth and you've said to yourself, why am I not sleeping on this? And then I can just chew on it while I'm sleeping on it. Or how about this? Someone else said it was like the tinkling of baby laughter in the moonlight. That's a pretty solid review. Baby laughter is pretty comfortable, y'all. So if you had to compare sleeping on the Casper mattress to anything, what would it be? It's really easy. You order online. It's delivered right to your door in a compact. How the hell do they fit that in that size box? It's available in the US, Canada, and now in the UK. Shipping and returns are free. That's right. You're going to try it 100 nights. And if you're not satisfied, then just send it back. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/nerdist. Use the offer code NERDIST. Terms and conditions apply. And now here's the Nerdist podcast number 894, ever closer inching to 900. And now Katie Levine is going to start the thing. Nick Swardson, start the thing. Play the song. All right.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Sorry, I'm just smearing peanut butter onto this banana.
No, that's one of my new, like, snacks. I'm on a diet right now. I have a trainer and, like, trying to cut weight and shit.
How do you feel?
I feel great.
Good.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, but banana peanut butter is, like, one of the things where it's like, if you're desperate for a snack and you need to, like, be on the go.
You got a little protein in there. You got some potassium. You just all the shit to keep that, you know, your body is an engine and you gotta fuel it properly. This is, by the way, this is, not a commercial at all because I don't get anything from these people, but Big Spoon. Big Spoon's fucking great peanut butter. Oh!
I'm just kidding.
How long have you been training?
I don't know, for like the past like 2 months.
Nice.
I start a movie in a week. I can talk about that on the air.
Well, let's start. Let's start.
Oh, you did?
That was it.
Oh, okay.
We're already recording.
Boom. Hi, America.
What if you're like...
Hi, world.
What if you're like, fuck, I don't want to fucking be here. This is the worst. I hate all this. Yeah, anyway, I'm working on a movie. It's really great.
God, I hope nobody finds out I'm here. Anyway, so what's up, Chris? Yeah, no, I'm...
Great. So start it now or before?
So now we roll? Cool.
Getting a lot of pussy out there?
Eating puss 24/7.
You did one of my favorite things on At Midnight the other day that I've been laughing about. It hits me in my car, but I don't remember, we were riffing. It was like someone was jerking off, so they pulled their dick off.
Oh, yeah, and I threw it.
But it was just the, fuck, and then just throwing
the penis.
He just was so like.
I was in the moment. I had channeled what somebody would do if they had jerked their penis off. And that it would be so horrifying that now it was just frustration that transcended any kind of horror. And it was just like, motherfucker!
Oh, this too? Like, it was just like, yeah. That was just the last straw. Like, the pulling off the dick was the last straw on a long day of, I got a parking ticket!
Yeah. It's or this too or not again! So it was like penis number two that they had, like, miraculously crafted onto another body around his body, and so he was just
they
like,
found a matching dick donor.
Yeah, they'd found a matching penis with the exact same circumference and
can
everything.
Can that happen? Are there if you're donating organs, can you donate a dick? Like, can you?
Wouldn't the penis be dead? Could you bring it back to life?
I mean,
with shock value,
can you harvest it the same way that you harvest in a similar way that you harvest an organ, or is it a specific type of tissue that's like, nope. It's once it's out, it's down.
I don't know. That's a valid question, though.
Dick donors?
Can you harvest it like you harvest corn? Is another question. Can you plant it and then grow stalks of cocks?
Yeah, I think you could, actually. I think that's exactly how that works.
These are valid questions.
And these are questions... So this is the premise of the film that you're working on, right?
Yes. Dick donors. I was just telling Chris I'm starting a film next week. We shoot in Canada, Vancouver, and it's a rated R kind of buddy comedy, and it's myself, Josh Duhamel, Dax Shepard, Olivia Munn, Kevin Dillon, Dave Bacadall, and
Chris Hardwick, because he's free now.
And Chris Hardwick. Are you free? Fuck.
After At Midnight. Yeah, After At Midnight's done. I got fucking time to...
Oh, shit.
You know, Talking Dead is only on Sundays. Other stuff, you know, stand-up is on the weekends.
Yeah.
I'm going, are you on the road at the moment?
I am after we film. We wrap, like, around Labor Day. And then I go on the road pretty hardcore until the end of the year. And then I do a new Netflix special.
Where do you workshop material?
I do clubs on the road. So, like, normally on tours, I'll do theaters and shit. But then to work out, like, I do clubs. And I kind of do anything. Like, I'll do clubs I started at. I'll do little clubs. I'll just do stuff to kind of fuck around.
Where did you start?
I started in Minnesota at the Acme Comedy Company.
It's one of the best comedy clubs in the country.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal club in Minneapolis. And I started there. And then I opened mic to 1996. And then it kind of just went from there. They made me the house MC at another club there after like a couple months. And then I just like really focused and then did the Aspen Comedy Festival. I got picked for that 6 months later.
Why is Minneapolis such a good comedy city? Is it because it's so cold most of the year that people just like to go indoors and watch things? It's such a great... There's like a really great artistic community in Minneapolis.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a combination of a lot of things. I think, you know, weather, and also I don't know if it's like, you know, it's really Scandinavian there, and I think I'm Swedish, and I don't know. I think they have a good sense of humor. They have kind of a funny sense of humor that's kind of bizarre. So I don't know if that attributes to it, but. Yeah, I don't know. The perspective, I mean, it's a great artistic scene in terms of, I mean, theater and everything. Like, I don't know. It's really, really cool.
I remember when I first saw you, I think probably Largo in like 90, it was in the 90s. And I was like, oh, you were this like wonder kid. He's like 23 or so. Like, you were really young.
Really young.
But also like way funnier than most people.
Oh, thanks.
So
man.
It's
happened really fast. So, long story short, when I was 16, I was in high school. I was a big drug addict, drug dealer. A lot of my friends were in gangs, disaster. You know, a lot of my friends were just train wrecks and drug dudes. And so I got arrested in school. During school, me and my friends were smoking blunts. And then the cops came and arrested us. And we... we got arrested, obviously, and handcuffed, and then I talked my way out of getting expelled, and I had to go to court-ordered rehab, and then I had to kind of clean up my act, and then I turned to theater to get an easy grade, because my grades were really bad, so that kind of started everything. I did theater, and I started doing comedy and improv within that theater company. Comedy Sports came to our school and recruited me and Colton Dunn, who's now on...
Yeah.
Superstore. He was my best friend in high school. So me and him started improv together, and then we just completely... So comedy took the place of drugs for me, where I'm like so obsessive compulsive. So where I was so full into doing drugs, I was done with that, and then it became so immersed in comedy and became such a psychotic student of comedy. So I did improv, and then I started stand-up right out of high school.
That's so... hearing that people that you don't know each other. It was like, I mean, I assumed you knew Colton, but I had no idea. Like, oh, okay. Well, there was something at that time in that group that, you know, there was obviously something magical about that. Because he's, like, your guys' careers both, you know, and it's not like you do stuff together.
Yeah.
But it's just crazy that you guys were friends in high school.
So bizarre.
Like, literally best friends, and you both have these amazing careers now.
Yeah, it's so random. This school in St. Paul, Minnesota, and... You know, yeah, it's really bizarre. I mean, it was cool when I worked on Pretend Time. I had this sketch on Comedy Central for a couple years. And, you know, it was cool to, like, hire Colton. And then he did sketches and was a writer on it. So it was, like, a cool moment when, you know, this guy, you've been creating stuff. You know, we would make videos in high school. We both performed for our senior graduation on stage and did, like, a whole skit. So, you know, it's cool in those, in that respect, to, like, come full circle and both of us are in Hollywood.
What, you know? Was Gay Robot a whole show, or was it just a sketch on Pretend Time?
No, Gay Robot started as a sketch on Adam Sandler's fifth album. So I was in his office, and he was like, hey, I'm doing another comedy album. We're doing sketches. If you have any ideas or any voices or anything you can think of. And I used to do this voice around the office where I would go like, hey, guys, what's up? And people always laughed at it. And I'm like, what does that sound like? I'm like, well, it sounds like a Gay Robot. And this was like 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And then Sandler was like, you should think about that as a TV show. So we did a live action pilot for Comedy Central. They shot that. And then they tested it, and they were like, the test audience says it's too gay, and it freaked them out.
What?
Yeah, Comedy Central, everybody. Comedy Central.
What do you guys think about the show? Oh, it's a little too gay
for
what I'm comfortable with.
This was my favorite part, is they told me this. They go, well, we tested it in a room of your demographic. So guys in their like late 20s at the time, late 20s. You know, in a room there was like 20 of them, and they watched it, and they all were, you know, they were like, yeah, this is gay and weird. I'm like, if you put a fucking room of 20, 25-year-olds and you ask them if a gay show, if they like it, they're going to be like, what? No, I don't fucking like it. No, what do you mean? Do I like it? Do I like it? No, it's weird. I'm like, you fucking idiots. Like, the show's called Gay Robot. Fucking assholes. And so they fucking canceled it. And then we put it on MySpace and everybody loved the show. And they're like, this is amazing. And I'm like, well, it's dead.
Well,
so great.
Well, maybe, I mean, but the idea of like, you know, the way that networks can focus group shows, like, okay, they just got like a random sampling of people in a mall and like, what do you think of that? And they're asking them to be critical. Then, you know, everyone who normally was like scratching their buttholes and like, you know, like lining up Funyuns on the end of their dick for entertainment goes in and they're like, oh, now I am in a power position. So
exactly.
Then they just start over-criticizing. Like, it's not an accurate way.
Not at all.
To measure what people are
going
to watch.
And it's essentially leading the witness. It's essentially going, okay, but yeah, but I mean, I've been in a million focus groups with movies and stuff that we made and fucking, it's the same thing where they're like, oh, what'd you think of this character? And like, oh, yeah, Hansu liked it. Okay, what'd you hate about him? And then nobody would say anything. And they'd be like, you must have hated something. I mean, like, what annoyed you? And then they would just, like, lead these people. And they're like, all right, well, I gotta say something. Yeah, his fucking face sucked, I guess. And
right.
It was just like, okay, his face sucks. It was just like, oh, my God. Like, what the fuck is happening? So we did Gay Robot then animated. And we shot and made that. And it came out really good. And then they canceled that. They didn't want to do it. And then I got Pretend Time because they felt bad about canceling a million things on me. So they gave me that show, and then I just put Gay Robot on that. I was like, I'll just keep them alive because we had the robot still built from Stan Winston Studios. It's like $250,000 robot that was made for something else that we just redressed as Gay Robot. And so, you know, it lived in these sketches, and then people still to this day keep trying to like get me to reincarnate it, but I've done every outside of claymation, or I don't know what the fuck
gay-mation,
to do with the
gay-mation.
Gay-mation. Gay-mation. Well, now it's done. The Nerdist presents Gay-mation. Gay Robot.
When did you first hook up with Sandler?
When I first really hooked up with him was when he brought me into his hotel room. No.
Yeah. That was
No, he was a fan of my stand-up. So he saw my first Comedy Central special. He was in bed with his wife, and they were just channel surfing. And this is, 12, 13 years ago? And he was just came across my first Comedy Central Presents and then wrote my name down and came into the office and was like, has anybody heard of this kid? And all the young guys were like, oh, it's Nick Swartzen. Yeah, he's on Comedy Central. And he's like, I want to meet him. And so I came into his office. My manager called me, and, you know, it was a surreal phone call. And he was like, I really like your comedy. I heard that you're a writer. We have this movie called Grandma's Boy. It's a broad PG-13 romantic comedy, but we want to make it hard R. So if you want to, if you want to do a pass at it.
I don't know why that's so funny. We want to make it hard R.
Yeah, literally. And so he's like, would you have any interest? He's like, you can write yourself into the movie, whatever you want to do, you know, whatever you want. And so I was like, yeah, you know, and I used to do jokes about my grandma, and that's what kind of gravitated him towards that idea. And so, you know, the rest is history. I rewrote it, and they loved it. Alan Covert, the lead, and Sandler. And then ever since then, I've been working with him ever since. He's like one of my best friends. And so I went on to doing that movie and other movies, and then his movies, producing, EPing, co-starring with him, and stuff like that.
I remember a lot of the jokes back around, but something about like you could be a superhero to like your grandma, like Nicholas, you're so strong.
Oh yeah, lifting a gallon of milk. Yeah, that was a true story. My favorite was my two grandmas at the time. They both passed on from crystal meth.
Yeah, and well, you know, really affecting the elderly community.
No, they both my grandmas fought over who the joke was about.
So oh, that's really sweet.
They were all like, it's about me. And then they would pull knives.
And then they murdered each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how they died.
They shivved each other on meth.
But I didn't know the part about being a drug dealer in high school. Because I knew you all. Didn't you also have a joke about like when you quit doing pot?
Smoking weed, yeah.
Yeah, you quit smoking weed that you feel like a genius because like you remember stuff.
Your memory comes back. Yeah, everybody thinks I'm this hardcore stoner because of Grandma's Boy and everything. But I don't smoke weed at all. I mean, the last time I smoked weed seriously, this is actually a pretty good story, was with Brian Posehn, of course. And this is, I'm going to say 18 years ago, possibly.
Oh, wow.
And it was at a party in the hills, in the valley, maybe Dave Rouse's house. And Brian was smoking a joint with Doug Benson, of course. It's two people that are completely guilty
it's
of
weird
doing
to
that.
Go off brand like that, but all right.
Let me just brace for this this intel. Brian Posehn, Doug Benson. So they're smoking a joint. I'm like, you know what? I had a little buzz from drinking. I'm like, fuck it, man. I'm going to come back to weed. So I go, can I get a hit? And Brian's like, oh, yeah. So I take the joint, and I crush, like, 10 deep hits. Oh, this is not having smoked weed for, like, a while. And I crush, like, 10 big hits, and then everybody was kind of like, whoa, because I know I didn't smoke weed. And then I grabbed a bottle of Captain Morgan's rum and just started drinking it.
Jesus Christ.
And then I go, and I start to kind of lose it a little bit, and I see Jackie Cation, and I go, can I get your car keys? And she was like, yeah, what's up? I go, I just need to go to the store. She goes, okay. She gives me her car
keys.
Oh,
shit.
Yeah. And then so I take her car, and I'm walking to my car, and I walk into Margaret Cho. And this was when Margaret was drinking a lot. And so we're both drunk. And I go, hey, Margaret. And she goes, hey, Nick, where are you going? I go, I'm going to the store. And she goes, are you okay? And I go, no. And then she just let me go. And then I just walked. And then I got into Jackie's car, and I'm driving through a neighborhood, which I didn't know. I lived in New York at the time. And I was started to get so fucking high. And this is, I'm not embellishing this at all. I started to think that I was in a dollhouse world. And all the homes were dollhouses. And I started to have a panic attack, and I decided to find a hospital. And then I couldn't maintain. I started to freak out. So I rolled down the window and started driving with my head out of the window.
You know, to keep you alert.
To keep me alert and awake and to not freak out. So then I'm just driving around. And then I just cut to, and I just wake up in a random hotel. I just got in a room. I don't remember, like, how I got into the room. And
how
I just
did Jackie get her car back?
I have no idea. I have no idea. And then she called me the next day, like, what the fuck?
Now, kids, we're laughing about this, but don't do that.
Don't do that.
Don't do this. This is a cautionary.
We laugh now.
You're lucky you didn't murder anyone.
Yeah, I mean, I think I wasn't as drunk as I was high. You know what I mean? So I think if, you know, it wasn't, you know, it was dangerous, whatever the fuck I was doing. But I think I quickly pulled over and found like a shitty hotel. So I think I realized that if I went any further, because I was just in like some residential. But yeah, it was do not fucking drink and drive or be fucked up and drive.
That's so crazy. I mean, what do you go get breakfast at that point? Or you're like, all right, well, you know, you just.
I was glad I was just not high anymore. I slept like really hard. I was just kind of like, oh, I made it. You know, it's just one of those things when you think back to, like, all the stuff you do. You know, I'm 40 years old now, and I think back to the fucking insanity I went through, and I'm just like, oh, my God, I'm just glad I made it through all that shit.
How did that happen?
Yeah, so it was just chalked it up to one of those, like, oh, my God. All right, back to one.
Do you ever think about, I mean, because I don't, you know, your stand-up, you express things in such a I mean, like, there are people who can write funny, and then there are people who are just naturally, like, any just the natural way that you present a story is hilarious. Do you ever talk about, like, really heavy stuff on stage?
I mean, I never really got into – I've dabbled with certain material I've written. I mean, I wrote some stuff about my dad dying and stuff like that that I thought was pretty funny. Like, I did a bit about – I'd written a bit about how – or thought of a bit about my dad died when he was 69 years old. And I'm so immature that I didn't want to say he was 69. So I just told people he was 68.
So they
because
wouldn't
I didn't want to have to go, like, 69. Like, yeah. That's how immature and dumb I am. And so, and I had, like, more material about that. And then I just was like, oh, nobody wants to hear about fucking death, like, in any capacity. So I just kind of bailed on stuff that was, like, got too, and it was always funny. I never got heavy-handed or, like, weird, dark or anything. But I just, you know, I was always of the school of, like, when people come to a show, they want to laugh and escape and not think about the horrors of things.
No, yeah, and it's because I did a lot of jokes about my dad dying in my last special, but it was interesting to test the line to see, like, oh, people are okay with this, but then this other thing is just what, like, I could never make, my stepmother had an open casket, which I just think is such a weird thing, because it's just like the most, you take a family reunion and then it's like infinitely more awkward because there's a person lying in the corner with just a coffin open, just, you know. And I had a little nephew who was probably like 4 or 5 at the time, and just like Dexter style, he just kept like propping himself up on the coffin and just like poking my dad. And part of me was like, I don't know if I'm okay with this, but then I was like, well, you know, he's curious. And, you know, it was such a surreal. So I was trying to, I thought that was so weird and morbidly funny, but I would, every time I just even mentioned the word like wake or like mentioned that he was in the corner, that like people just checked out, like there was no there was like a or they just you can sometimes you just feel the air like just go out of the
room.
Like,
totally,
that was the line. They just were not, I think it just needed either a more skilled, you know, Louis probably could have gotten away with it, but
yeah, I mean, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. There was another bit that I would do. And I'm doing a new special with Netflix, and I might put this on it because I really love the bit, but it never destroys at all. But it's essentially about how when you're 80 years old or above, you can die at any second.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's a horrifying thing to go, oh, because it's really hard to plan your next day, like to really in concrete make plans. So I was saying, like, if you're a grandfather and your grandson's like, hey, Grandpa, do you want to go to the zoo tomorrow? And you're like, yes, I do want to go to the zoo. Let's plan on that. But there's a chance you'll come to my home and I will be a dead body and you'll be horrified and scarred for the rest of your life. Hopefully we'll go to the zoo. But that is what I hope happens. I'm just saying there is a chance that you will find a lifeless corpse of me, you know, and I just
the zoo's great,
going.
But the zoo's great.
And yeah, the zoo would be phenomenal, and the monkeys and tigers.
But it's all like, I guess when you get to a certain age, like every day on your calendar, just you have to pencil it in. You're like, I'm just pencil this one in. But I think you should do jokes like that, because I think, you know, I think sometimes you sort of get the idea like, oh, but everyone should be laughing. But I still think there are ones where even if just a smaller group of people are laughing extra hard.
Totally, 100%.
Those a lot of times those are sometimes the bits where someone go, oh man, I saw you do this bit this one time and I fucking loved it. And you go, I hate that bit, never worked.
Yeah,
you,
totally.
You know?
100%. That's why I said that I might do it. And not that I need every bit to destroy. I didn't mean it like that. But it was like, you know, when stuff just it didn't really have an ending. So maybe I just am lazy and I didn't really write like a kind of an end thought to it. But, yeah, I do. I mean, I've said random shit over the years that people have come up to me, like you said, and been like, dude, that one bit. I'm like, what? Especially, like, Largo. Largo in Los Angeles, like, Chris and I kind of came up at that place that used to be on Fairfax. And it was such a haven for material that didn't work. I mean, I would always do stuff that was so rogue and bizarre. And people still to this day would always bring up those bits that I love that were just kind of really like non sequiturs and strange, like stuff that was in the news or something like. And yeah, that was one thing about Largo that I always loved.
Well, yeah, because that scene was born out of the, I mean, for lack of a better term, the alternative comedy movement, but it was basically like anti-comedy club. So it was sort of this punk. I think it started as a sort of punk comedy movement of comedians going like, hey, you don't want us in your clubs. We don't want to fucking be in your clubs. So we're going to start our own thing, and we're just going to read off notebooks and just tell stories. I think it was a rebellion to like the comedy bubble. And like a million people, and like short attention span theater, like here's 9 people doing jokes about the Flintstones,
right?
You know? And it was like it was a rebellion against like you know, just sort of mainstream comedy club, you know, comics without substance that were just doing jokey jokes. And so it was all like, you know, talk about your day. It's like talk, read stuff from your notebook, do a lot of throwaways, do anything that felt too formed. I felt like put that audience off a little bit, but then it evolved.
Right.
And then it became more structured comedy with just a different bank of references.
Yeah, no, definitely it started out because when I was living in New York in the late 90s and I was doing Luna Lounge, and that scene took off in the mid 90s with Garofalo and a lot of people. And, you know, that scene, yeah, came out of, yeah, people not wanting to go, yeah, not wanting to hit the clubs and just be so... I don't even know how you would describe it, but yeah, I mean, the alternative movement was more just not having like smooth segues and not being so polished and so, you know, bow tie and like, all right, you know, you know, my wife is like, you know, if I can has AIDS or whatever. Nobody
you know
would ever say that.
Classic comedy club bit.
I mean, nobody would say that.
Here's 9 comics talking about how their wife.
No, but. But I really attribute that scene of really defining my comedy in the sense that when I started, you know, you're always trying to survive on stage and do amazing. And then when I moved to New York, I was so high energy and I was so physical and I was just trying not to get booed off. And I was, you know, the East Coast, the audiences are a lot less forgiving. I mean, they're, you know, their patience, like they can, if they don't like something, you'll fucking know it. So I was always really, you know, really high energy and really trying to, you know, do my best, which is always good to do. But, you know, when I started doing the alternative scenes, I could do the weirdest shit and I could do the stuff that was really off and I could bring my energy way down. I learned to just kind of talk and not be so anxious and not be so loud and, you know, crazy. So it really, really helped me a lot. And then when I moved to LA and, you know, Luna Park and Largo and those scenes were really great. I always did comedy clubs and continue to do them, but it just helped the writing process and just helped you open up your brain a little bit, open up your mind.
So you're sort of able to use the scenes in LA as like, oh, I'll just try stuff out here, and then if it kind of works, I'll take. I always found a difficulty with stuff that worked really well at Largo a lot of times did not work really well on the road. And I had, you know, I was like, oh, I kind of got to write different jokes for the road than stuff that I was doing.
Yeah, I mean, most of what I do at Largo, I'll do on stage. I mean, I'll do it at the Improv. I'll do it at the Laugh Factory. I mean, you know, there isn't stuff that's so... I mean, like, but like I said, like my bit about dying and about, you know, like that's a bit that would do really well at Largo. Like
right.
That would kill. You know, but if I did the Improv, like the audience would be like, you know, they wouldn't be as on board.
Right.
You know what I mean? So in that sense, Largo was always good because you could go weird and dark and they would be with you.
Right.
You know, because they kind of expect that of, you know, what that venue has to offer.
Well, yeah, it really is about expectations of the audience. And if the audience, like a random sampling of people who come to the Improv or the Comedy Store or whatever, they don't come going, I wonder if I'm going to be challenged tonight. Like, they just, they want to just come and laugh at things that they understand pretty quickly and
right.
not anything where it's like, oh, we're going to talk about death now? Or we're going to talk about, you know.
Yeah. I mean, but I also, on the flip side, I would get mad at comics that would look down on me because I would do comedy clubs. So I remember young comedians would be like, oh, you do the road? Oh, you do, like, what, like, comedy clubs? And I was like, yeah, I'm a fucking comedian. So then I hated what that scene spawned of, like, these fucking hipster, like, too cool and, like, too above certain kinds of comedy where it was like, oh, like, when I started working with Sandler, like, so many people, like, kind of turned on me. And they're like, oh, like, whatever, and just, like, kind of, like, shit on me.
Because he was too mainstream?
Well, because he was like, oh, he's so broad and whatever, what the fuck, but... You know, Adam, if you look at his old stand-up, he and Dave Rath will say this. He was like, David Spade and fucking Adam Sandler and Rob Schneider were like alternative before alternative even existed. Like, he's like, they would go up and do like weird shit on stage, and they would tank, and they would do, you know, bits were like outside the box, and he's like, it was so funny that people would like shit on them. And then, you know, so it was my point being, like, you know, there is that flip side where you can also be, you know, a little small minded if you get in that bubble of like, oh, you do like, oh, you do the road. And I was like, yes, I do the road.
Comedians also,
do the road.
Like, red, like, if it's all just context too, because I think if you saw Sandler doing like the Redheaded Sweatshirt song and you didn't know who he was and it was an alternative comedy venue, you'd be like, holy shit.
Right.
That's crazy. You know, like,
yeah,
but,
totally.
But because it was contextualized in SNL and he was really famous and you knew what it was, that automatically made it mainstream. I mean, that's the thing about hipsterism, is that hipsterism, hipsterism does not actually like things for their actual qualities. It only follows trends. So it's like, oh, well, if that's popular, I can't like it. Like, well, right. Then you don't really like comedy. You just like trends.
Yeah.
So like stuff because you like it. It doesn't matter if it's famous or not famous. Just like stuff because you like it. And if you like Sandler, then you like him. If you don't like Sandler for the reasons that you don't like the jokes, then that's fine too. But
yeah.
Don't just make it a broad, like, these people are in this box and I can't like them because I won't look cool if I like that thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's funny. Like, just exactly what you're talking about, where I have people, you know, watch movies that I do with him or watch stuff that I do on my own, and people are like, yeah, I mean, you know, I laughed really hard at that movie. I mean, it was so fucking dumb and I didn't want to laugh at it, but, you know, it made me laugh. And I'm like, why don't you just say it made you laugh? What's what? Like, why are you filling in blanks that don't exist? Like, why are you? Who's really, judging you?
It's also really insulting. I think what you do is shitty, but, you know, I did laugh at it. Like, why do you have to qualify
it? It's insane because I snapped. I did an Ivy League school once, and or borderline Ivy. It was like Wash U, which is like a really good school. I don't think it's Ivy League, actually. But I heard it was really good. And so I was doing it. It's in Missouri, St. Louis, I think. Anyway, I'm on stage, and these kids are, you know, really smart, bright kids. And they're watching me, and I'm doing okay. This is, you know, about 12 or 15 years ago. And I do this joke, and I go, my cat's sick right now. I go, my cat has diarrhea. And I had to take him to the vet. And the vet's like, well, what have you been feeding him? And I was like, diarrhea. And the crowd, dead silence. And then some kid rolls his eyes in the front row, and I hear him go, oh my God, that's so stupid. And I fucking snapped, and I looked at him and I go, did you just say it's stupid? I go, I know it's fucking stupid. That's the point of the joke. I go, don't be above the fucking, I know it's dumb. That's why it's funny, is it's so stupid. I fucking know that, you fucking idiot.
Well, it's also like,
and it's one of those things where like so much comedy is like, when people are like, oh my God, are you kidding me? It's just like, yeah, but some people are in on the joke too.
Yeah.
Like some people are like...
Which is funny because you think the person that acts like they're above it is actually completely missing the point of it.
Totally missing the
like,
point of it.
Yes. It's a very hard thing to explain with comedy. Like, I can't believe this person said that. Well, they were probably saying that from the point of view of a character that they were doing that is the most ridiculous thing that person
exactly,
could say.
Exactly, 100%.
Not that that is something that they believe. It's not you know, like, I don't know why people sometimes take comedy like it's a lecture series. Like, everything that comes out of your mouth is 100% literal. Like,
yeah.
No, you have to look for the nuance and the context and the layers and understand the theatrics of it. It's not, you know, I think people just get confused because they think one person's talking on stage, so it's like a speech. No, yeah. There's a whole narrative. Like, you have to understand what the story is and the meta story and the context.
Totally.
And the person who's doing it and what they're, you know, what they're about. Like, there's so, I think comedy sometimes is a little more, it's just a little more thought and work than I think, you know, because I'm sure you've done a million colleges, and sometimes people don't understand that comedy requires a little bit of, it's like you can't just drop a raw steak and go dinner. It's like you have to prepare it. You
yeah.
have to make sure it's prepared properly. With comedy, you need a little bit of, you know, Todd Glass is insane about it. You just gotta like get the tables close, just put the curtains behind there, just put little candles on the, you know, like
yeah.
He's got all the, but there are a lot of things that really, you can't just stick comedy somewhere and go, okay, comedy.
Yeah, no. And I love doing colleges. I do a lot of colleges and a lot of people hate them, but I have a blast doing them. And it's like, you know, there was that whole thing that came out where comedians, I think Louis, right, and like Seinfeld were like, fuck colleges, fuck, you know, fuck that. And, you know, I was like, I fucking love doing colleges. And they're like, well, they don't fucking get shit and they don't get this and that. And it's like, yeah, but if you think about it, you know, they're new to comedy. They're new to live performances. They're new to live comedy. You know, they're hungry to, like, it's good to, like, you know, bring them up on certain kinds of comedy and bring, like, have them show them fucking certain shit that's weird and certain stuff that, you know, is out of the box. You know what I mean? Maybe they won't get it at the time, but, like, the more they think about it, you know, I don't know. I like doing, you know, schools and, you know, maybe they don't go great, but, you know, it's good to just, like, have them fucking see shit that's, you know.
Well, also, too, so, you know, some comics require that you really pay attention to what they're saying.
Right.
And I think some, you know, it's even more than just that these students are new to comedy. They're kind of new to life.
New
still,
to life, 100%.
You know, like,
because
they were only just barely adults.
Yeah.
And so it really, you have to live a little bit before you understand the irony behind the darkness in life and why it's okay to laugh at those things. As a defense mechanism or to gain control over, you know, to get some sense of control over that. And so you're basically, they've been in school probably their, you know, they've been in school their whole lives.
They have no life experience.
And all of a sudden, an adult, which they're normally used to seeing say things that they're required to, you know, they have to take seriously, is now saying, like, pussy farts. And they're like, what? Like, I think it's hard for sometimes for them to process it.
100%.
Because it's contextually weird for them. And they don't – you get a lot of ooh sometimes because they don't know, like, yes, you can laugh at death. You can laugh at tragedy because that's how human beings deal with things. They just haven't – sometimes they haven't experienced enough shitty things in their lives.
No, of course. And I – yes, of course. I mean, I should have said that before. Yeah, it's not just live comedy. No, they don't. They don't have a lot of life experience, you know.
Some really do.
But for the most part.
But by and large, you know, they have to kind of live a little bit to go, oh, okay, I get it now.
Yeah, and you have to know your audience. I mean, like a lot of comics that I know that don't like colleges, I mean, you know, they're married with kids and they talk about that, you know, that perspective. And it's, I mean, that's, you know, really hard, you know, for a lot of college kids to be like, what? I mean, even in my new set, I talk about having kids and stuff like that. And, you know, they can't, like, wrap their hearts or their heads around it. But, you know, what was my point? I can't remember what I was saying.
Fuck colleges?
No.
Okay, no, it's not the answer.
No. But also, like, coming back to context, like, know your situation, what, you know, like, with people who hate, I guess, you know, if I bring it back to Adam Sandler, like, all these critics, like, just hate, like, you know, the movies and stuff, and it's like, well, just then don't see them. It's like, that's like the easiest thing when I'm always,
well,
like,
that is...
why don't you just not? So it's like, you know, I get like why Louis and Seinfeld are like, yeah, we don't, you know, we hate colleges, and it's like, yeah, okay, well, yeah, then just don't do them. Like, you know, they're just like, we're not going to do them anymore, you know. But it's funny that, you know, people put themselves into situations.
Well,
and
it is a strange, it is kind of funny that everyone just assumes that all the responsibility for entertainment is. It's like, if I don't like something, it's your fault. We're like, well, no, it's your fault if you don't like something, or it's your issue, and you don't have to like everything, but everything doesn't have to be for you.
Right.
You can just not – it's exactly what you said. Like, when people complain about something week after week, I gotta watch the show, and this happened, or I hate this guy's comedy. Like, well, just don't fucking watch it. Like, I don't think I've ever had to declare that I wasn't going to watch something. I just don't watch stuff that doesn't resonate with me, and that's okay. Not everything is for everyone. But I think everyone expects that everything has to be for them. Like, no, it doesn't. You just don't have to watch
it. No. Yeah, and also, like, comedy, and you know this, and this is such a simple statement, it's like, comedy is so fucking subjective. It's so subjective. So when people, like, will go, like, oh, Nick Swardson is fucking not funny at all. And it's like, well, no, I am, because I've done this for a long time. So if you want to say, I don't think Nick Swardson's funny, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. But when people, like, make blanket statements like, yeah, no, this show's not funny at fucking all. It's like, yeah, it is. If people are watching it, it's in season
four. To other people it might be
funny.
That's
always funny to me that people...
Well, everyone loves to state their opinion as some sort of a universal truth.
No, they love it. I'll never forget, I was watching, I don't even know why, but I stumbled across Roper at the movies or whatever, and they were reviewing Zohan, and a movie I was in that I love, I was a part of, and Richard Roper had a guest reviewer on, and Richard Roper's like, okay, we're reviewing Zohan, you know, all annoyed, and the other reviewer goes, yeah, I saw it. He goes, I really, really like this movie. He goes, I thought it was interesting that Sandler made, you know, this kind of broad comedy about the Israeli and Israeli-Palestine situation. And he's like, the subject matter was really unique for a comedy. You know, he's like, there was a lot of really funny jokes and blah, blah, blah. And Richard Roper just stopped him and he just goes, wait, what are you saying? Wait, are you saying you like this movie? And the guy's like, yeah, I thought it was pretty good, man. I laughed. And he was like, all right, let's just stop right there. This is real. He said this. He's like, let's just stop right there. This movie's fucking horrible. He didn't say fuck. But he was like, this movie's horrible. This is ridiculous. And then just totally like shit on the reviewer. And then just shit on the movie. And I was like, fuck you, man. Like, this guy can't just, like, point out the things that he liked. Like, real cool, Richard Roper, you like, fucking dork.
Why can't...
Fuck you. Like, what a fucking asshole.
As opposed to him just saying, like, oh, okay, well, you can like the movie. I personally didn't like it, but that's my opinion and you have your opinion.
I didn't like it, and here's why I didn't like it. And not like, what? He, like, literally cut this guy off like a fucking cunt. Fuck Richard Roper.
Listen, you have a lot of stuff to process.
Sorry about the C. Guess what? Not sorry. Guess what? Not sorry.
Well, you know, I think there's also, because there are certain websites that review music or comedy, and I feel like they, and they're considered more alternative, but sometimes I feel like, but you guys have a brand that you stick to because you know there are certain things that your audience will not accept for you to like, and so you know that there are easily things when they come out that go, yeah, well, that's a piece of shit, and other things that I feel like I feel like some people or bands get a pass and like, you know, this was okay. I thought this was okay, but you know, but then they totally like slobber all over the knob of it, and you're like, because you know they know their audience expects them to,
yeah, totally,
even on a subconscious level. And I'm not saying they can't like those things, but sometimes I do detect patterns where I'm like, nah, I don't know. It sort of feels like you're just maybe staying on brand a little bit. Because if you know, if one of these websites was like, oh, actually, I really did like the Zohan, the audience would be like, what?
Yeah.
What are you saying, man? Like, people, yeah. Thought we were on the same side, man. You know, like it just. I don't believe anything.
It's a funny world that like now it's so insane with social media. And it's funny to think that we started in a time. I mean, if you can imagine comedy without social media,
what?
It's so bizarre. You know, music is funny because I used to open for David Cross, who's a very good friend, and I opened for him for years, and we used to get in music fights all the time. Because I like pop music. Like, I'll like pop. You know, I have, like, Justin Bieber songs on my phone and stuff. And, like, David just, like, would just not, back in the day, be like, are you fucking kidding me, man? You have a song by Pink? And I'd be like, yeah, I like Pink. Okay, it's funny. Don't.
What can I like? What I like?
Yeah, but it was funny. Like, he was just somebody that was always getting into it with music.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because this is, you know, something that I always remind you of, because it's one of my favorite things. But we were performing at Bumbershoot 1 year, and a knock came on my hotel room door, and then you and David Cross came in completely naked and started jumping up and down on the bed, going, yeah. Wee! Yay!
Full nude.
So I've seen both your dicks, which was great.
Yeah.
And but what really impressed me was at some point walking down the hall, you guys said, well, let's just go in there nude. You took all your clothes off in the hallway,
yeah,
left your clothes in the hallway, so you still had to go back out in the hallway and get your clothes.
Yeah.
So can you just give me some of the – do you remember any of the backstory on
– I mean, David – you know, I love David so much. I don't see him as much. He's married now and shit. And yeah, we had such a blast for years. David was just always – he would always just do shit like that. He'd be like, let's fucking... And I'm, like, game for anything. Like, I'm always... If anything's fucking weird, I'm totally down. And so I remember he was like, let's fucking just run in naked. And I'd be like, all right. And it wasn't even, like, a blink of an eye. And, like, I would throw shit at him, too, all the time. And, like, it was so fun. And we would do shows, and I'd be like, what are we doing after? And he's like, let's... He goes, I know about this after party in this attic. And I'm like, all right. And we would just do shit like that. And our big thing on the road was breaking into hotels, but breaking into hotel pools. So we would find hotels and we would break into their pool and go swimming at like 2 a.m. And I remember one time, I think we were in Seattle, and we broke into this hotel pool and we went swimming. This old security guard's like, what comes in after like 20 minutes? And he's like, what are you guys doing, man? The pool's closed. And we're like, what? Really? And it was like, clearly it was, the lights were off. It was clearly closed. And we're like, sorry about that. And he's like, all right. And he just left. And then we just kept swimming. And he came back like 15 minutes later. He goes, hey, I said the pool's closed. And we're like, oh, it's closed now? And he was like, yeah. And we're like, oh, I thought you meant tomorrow. And he's like, no, no, it's now. And we're like, okay. And he left. And we just kept staying. And he came back. He's like, you guys got to get out of the pool, man. And we're like, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. It's so embarrassing. And he's like, it's okay. So, like, we just kept doing shit like that. One time, David got me to do crystal meth, which I had never done before.
Holy shit.
And, yeah, David, one time we were in Atlanta, me and him and Mary Lynn. And David was like, hey, do you want to do – he's like, let's get fucked up tonight. And I was like, all right, why don't we do drugs? And he goes, well, do you want to try crystal meth? And I'm like, well, that's a drug and one of the most aggressive drugs. And I go, no, I'm not doing crystal meth. And he goes, I know, I hear you. He goes, but he goes, here's the deal. You just put a little bit in your drink. He's like, I'm not going to shoot it or smoke it. But he goes, I have a little bit, and you just put like a little bit in your drink. And I go, all right.
Jesus.
So David puts like a pinch in my drink and puts a pinch in Mary Lynn's.
Crystal Light.
Yeah, Crystal Light. The Dark Crystal Light.
The Dark Crystal Light. There it is.
So that's the movie. So we fucking drink it, and we go out to a bar, and my body goes completely numb. And I'm not enjoying myself at all because I can't feel my body. And then I'm starting to have a panic attack. And then I grab Mary Lynn and I go, are you having fun? And she goes, I can't feel my body.
Oh, my God.
And I go, this is fucking horrible. I go, I got to get air. So I walk outside and I'm totally numb and I'm really freaking out. And I'm trying to drink through it and it's not working. So then Mary Lynn's not having fun either. And so I go to find Cross, who's on the dance floor, like basically fucking going full Saturday Night Fever, like just dancing all over the place. I go, David, are you having fun? He's like, yeah, this is fucking great. And I was like, oh my God, I go, me and Mary Lynn are not having fun. We can't feel our bodies. He's like, oh, all right. And then so I think we just grabbed a cab and went back to the hotel.
But see, that's it's probably one of the reasons why I was never able to do drugs, because if I had that experience, I would have fucking run in front of a train. Like, I would have tried to free my spirit from my body, because I would have had
just
such,
eject your seat.
Yeah, I would have had such a panic attack that I would not have been able to handle it. So I don't even, you know, I remember, now it's been 14 years since I quit drinking, but before that, you know, someone tried to get me to do mushrooms or ecstasy or something, and they go, it feels really good. And they're like, I mean, there's a minute where you kind of don't know what's happening. I go, that's 1 minute too long. Don't want to do it. No thanks. Like, that minute would have felt like hours to me. So how are you even, because now you've explained two things where you had these horrible panic attacks. How did you push through those?
You just ride it out.
Oh, it sounds terrible.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big drug guy at all, but I've dabbled. And, like, it's always – there's nothing worse than doing that. And that moment where you realize, okay, I've just got to ride this out. I did that with fucking cocaine a couple times. I did it with alcohol where I got – like, a couple years ago, I got altitude sickness and alcohol poisoning. And I fucking was so sick and hungover and – it was such a nightmare, and I realized there was just nothing I could do. I just had to ride it out. It was just 2 days of, like, literally can't sleep, like, hallucinating. It was fucking horrible.
Well, because there are some people, and I don't know if Dave's one of those people, but there are some people that just, they'll just see a pill on the ground, they'll go, I'll try that. And I need to, like, even if I'm taking Tylenol, like, I need to look at the pill, make sure it says Tylenol.
Right,
make sure the bottle has not been tampered with, and I'll check it, like, 5 times.
Yeah, totally.
And they'll go, okay, it's okay to take this. If someone just goes, hey, I'm going to sprinkle this random thing in a drink, I'd be like, I mean, especially now, but even back then, I don't think I would have been able to handle that.
Yeah, I mean, it's more of a testament to how much I trusted Dave. And, like, Dave doesn't do crystal meth, by the way. This was, like, a weird – so don't, like, get me wrong. Like, David's not, like, does not do meth. But this was just, like, a random thing where David was like, hey, I've got this. Like, should we just, like, try it? Like, I think he had done it once before, but – and I just trusted David. But I never, ever do stuff like that. I rarely – like, I don't even smoke weed, so it's like – you know, I don't. I know exactly what you're talking about. I would never give. I mean, I have friends that, yeah, if you hand them something, they'd be like, all right.
I mean, the thing for me with drinking was that at least it made me. It was one of the ones that made you feel like you're in control. Like, it almost makes you feel like you're too much in control, or you're like, I'm fine, you know, because you just feel, you know.
Even when you're out of control, you're kind of in control in a weird way. Like, when I get shit-faced, which obviously I'm a notorious drinker, like a big drinker. I don't drink as much as I used to. But, yeah, I always liked getting, like, royally fucked up. Because in my head, I still, like, knew what was going on. I would never get to the point where I didn't know what was going on. And I thought it was funny if I was naked or like taking a shit on a house or something.
I never felt like my brain was separated from my body. Like right. If I ever had any kind of
There's no existential weird like out or like, you know, I was never outside of my body drinking or looking down on my fucking child self or.
Yeah.
there was none of that.
You look in the mirror and you just see a wolf head. You're like, what's happening?
I had one too many sea breezes.
Now I'm a wolf person?
Why is my mom crying blood? Yeah, no. Alcohol, you know what you're going to fucking get.
But I think the last time, and I was still drinking at the time, but I think...
You were a monster drinker. I remember that. Oh, you and Paul F. Tompkins. Like those Largo days.
Oh, boy.
We were all just... We would just get shit-faced.
Yeah. Yeah, because it was so easy to... The show started a little bit late. It was like 9 o'clock on a Monday night. All right, well, I'm going to go out and have drinks and then go... And then you're at Largo, and it's just such a...
Drinks were plentiful.
Plentiful. And I remember just like having the weird thing of like, can I perform without drinking? And then I realized pretty quickly, oh yeah, it's great. I can actually think a million times clearer than before.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, I felt like I just didn't know because I'd only done it that way before. But it was very comforting to realize like, oh yeah, I'm actually better than I was, you know. So I killed that myth. Where like, if I don't drink, maybe I'm not an artist. Maybe I got it. I'm like, nah, that's bullshit.
Yeah, no, but it is a logical thing. And it's funny how like, and you know this too, like it is such a different skill set because I performed fucking hammered. You know, in short sets, of course, like I wouldn't do like an hour show, but like, you know, if I have 10 minutes of improv, I would get fucking annihilated.
Right.
And, you know, shows would go good. But then when I'm sober, you know, it is like two different kind of mindsets. I mean, obviously it is. But it's funny. Like, yeah, performing sober, I would prefer that. You know what I mean? I like being alert and being in the moment and not, you know, being out of it for a step, you know?
Yeah. But a lot of it's, I mean, you know, a lot of that stuff was all just, what I realized later was just like, oh, it's anxiety management just because I'm such an anxious, like, you know, my molecules vibrate.
Right.
And it was just such a numbing process of like, when I first started doing comedy, I was so scared. I would drink, you know, like 3 or 4 beers just before I would get on stage because I was so terrified.
Yeah.
And it was really nice to realize, like, oh, I didn't have to do that. Like, you can – it's okay to be scared. Like, that's not a big deal.
Yeah, that's part of it. I mean, good Lord. Yeah, I mean, that's that kind of anxiety is – when I was starting out is I mean, I always kind of just channeled that when I would get on stage and use that, like, fucking horrified energy. I used to, like, almost vomit before I would go on stage.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
You always seem so comfortable to me on stage.
Well, I'm talking, like, when I was, like, 19. When I first started, just, like, that sheer terror. I mean, now I love it. I mean, now it's honestly, and it sounds kind of cliche, but, like, I really am the most comfortable, I think. You know, when I'm on stage, I love being on stage. To me, it's, like, just so comforting.
It is. You know, like, my manager Alex and my wife both said the same thing to me separately, which was, oh, you always seem happiest after you've done sets. I'm like, oh my God, you're right. I mean, because that's when you sort of feel like, oh, I'm doing what I'm doing. Like I'm doing what I do. Like this is what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah. Do you have this? I've experienced this even now. Like when I do shows, if I have a show on the road that night, my day is kind of off. Like my brain is so, like knowing I have a show completely alters my demeanor my mindset is off. Like I just, an hour before I go on, I'm a complete mental patient.
And then you get on stage and everything's fine.
Everything's fine when I'm on stage. But like, you know, my state of my mind is so bizarre. It's like, I get really like tired and kind of morose and really weird. I don't know if that happens to you.
Because I think, you know, when I first started going on the road, I was like, oh, it's going to be great. I got all day. I can write all day. I can do another. And then you weirdly don't do, or I don't really do anything.
No.
And I think part of it is, I think your body is unconsciously, subconsciously conserving energy.
Yeah.
For this, like,
totally
massive blast of energy that you have. Because sometimes I would have, you know, amazing shows that were so much fun, do 2 shows, maybe 3 shows in a night, and then afterwards just feel almost depressed, like just empty, like,
yeah.
What do I,
I don't know, you know, just because it all you're scooping out all the energy. So I think sometimes that's your body is preparing itself for the amount of energy that it has to.
Yeah, for sure. Because it's the most unnatural thing.
It is a very unnatural thing.
Yeah.
Hey, get up and listen to me. What I have to say is really important, everybody.
Hi, thousands of people. What's going on?
Stuff's weird. Just want to make sure you know that.
Cats.
Just so I feel okay. Oh, you. I can remember. Did you have a joke about?
Oh, shit.
It was like. You're gonna go at three. Did you have a joke about where it was something about a movie preview or like coming this summer and it was just wolf pussy?
No. I had a joke with the punchline wolf pussy, but that was not the setup.
Okay.
So I had a joke about a dramatic movie trailer for like a World War II movie. Like, you know, mother forced to raise her children, her father or her husband, you know, killed and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, in a world and all they have is each other. And then I had a thing that was called Shit Factory, the movie. And I would switch titles and one of them was called Gay Boobs. And then Wolf Pussy was another punchline. If when I grow old, I'm going to return food at a restaurant. And when they're like, what's wrong with it? I'm going to be like, it tastes like wolf pussy. And then the waiter's like, what the fuck?
I think that was also in the same era of comedy where you said you're gonna leave a lot of money to like weird celebrities to show up to your
funeral.
Oh,
yeah, John Stamos and everything.
Do you know, is that Mr. T?
Yeah. Does Nick know? And then I became friends with John Stamos, which was really cool.
He was like the nicest, coolest guy.
Yeah, he was like, heard you got a joke about me. I was like, yeah, motherfucker.
Now he might actually show up to your funeral if you die before.
I know. Now it's not even a joke anymore.
It's a real thing.
Real life.
Real life as expressed through jokes.
Yeah.
This really does taste like wolf pussy. I can't. This was just
Swartzen.
A joke. So Typical Rick, where can people see Typical Rick?
Here's a fun story about Typical Rick. Me and Simon Rex, a.k.a. Dirt Nasty, play two guys who are buddies. Best friends in Iowa. I moved to Hollywood to become the next Daniel Day-Lewis. He's kind of my tag-along friend. And then he ends up getting a lot more attention and befriending a lot everybody just because he's good-looking and clueless. And I work really hard. And so it's this kind of, you know, not Dumb and Dumber, but an odd couple meets Dumb and Dumber type of thing. And, yeah, it's streaming on Comedy Central. You can watch it on YouTube on Comedy Central's page. Nick Goosen, who directed Grandma's Boy, directs it. This season, we've got cameos from Charlie Sheen, Chris D'Elia, Michael Rosenbaum, Nikki Glaser, Peter Dante, Theo Vaughn, like great people. And the show is just, so you know, is already canceled. So Comedy Central, so when I was on At Midnight, I was promoting a show that had already been canceled on a show that it was canceled.
Yes, yes.
So I think that that's almost unprecedented to be on a canceled show promoting a show that's canceled.
That's like a canceled-ception. Like, yeah, that's just like so many layers
canception.
Deep. Well, I owe Simon Rex a huge apology because he showed up the day that he was at the last show.
Yeah, he came to a taping.
Before everyone knew that the show was canceled. And it was after that show, when everyone left, that we told the crew, okay, we just found out, you know, it's only a couple, you know, we're only going to do a couple more weeks. And so Simon was booked for the following week, and so he came to see the show.
Yeah.
And I've known Simon since MTV days.
Right.
You know? And but in the last handful of episodes, we decided that we were going to give everyone who had been on the show a lot a chance to kind of come back and say goodbye.
Yeah,
to the show.
Of course,
so,
and he understood that.
So I felt really bad about that. He ended up not being on, and I remember shaking hands with him in the back of my head, going, "Oh boy, are you sure you had to come to this one? I'm so sorry."
Yeah,
so
no, sorry. It's fine. He totally understood.
Good, but you've always been amazing on the show, and you know,
no, I had a blast.
And
man,
you know, personally, I adore you, so I will do anything for you ever. So,
thanks, man. Well, feeling is mutual, man. You're the best.
I'm excited for you, and I'm excited that you're starting this new movie. Can you say what the movie is?
It's called The Buddy Games.
Great.
And it's it's gonna be super fun. But I'm on camera, so I have a trainer now, and I eat really well anyway, but I'm eating good, and I have this trainer because I'm on screen with Josh Duhamel and Dax, and you know, like I have like shirtless scenes, and I was just like, all right, I don't want to look like a fucking pile of mayonnaise. The fucking
Josh Duhamel just looks like he was carved out of marble.
Yeah, it's insane. Like, even if he weren't famous, he would just drop your groceries and be like, whoa, who's this?
Put this. I don't know why I'm presenting, but I
get inside me. But yeah, no, he's the best dude ever. So it'll be fun.
Excellent. Thank you, Nick Swardson.
Love you, Chris.
And I love you too. Enjoy your breed, everybody.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.